Welcome to Comfortably Unnumb, the official podcast of the Umbrella Society. My name is Blake Anderson. I'm the host of this podcast. I'm also the programs manager here at the Umbrella Society in beautiful Victoria, British Columbia, on the traditional unceded territory of the Lekwungen-speaking people. And today, I'm very excited to have on a special guest. For me, I'm really excited because this is somebody that I admire greatly. Leroy is on the program today. He is a local legend on the Victoria music scene. You know, as a fellow musician, this is somebody that I have looked up to for a long time. He is a renowned singer-songwriter in not only Canada, but also internationally, and also a wonderful producer. So, you know, this is somebody that I've followed as a musician for many years. And I noticed maybe a couple months ago that Leroy posted something on his page, speaking to his, recovery and the journey that he has taken in this last 17 years of sobriety. It was a really heartfelt and, genuine and vulnerable post. And I was, really taken away by how powerful it was for me to be reading this. And I reached out, I had to get him on the program as soon as I read this. And, I'm very grateful that he graciously accepted my invitation and has taken time out of his busy schedule to come in and speak about his recovery journey and the steps that he has taken, in recovery. So, once again, very excited to have on the program Leroy. Okay, Leroy, thank you so much for coming on here. I think I was just mentioning to you, I've been a big fan of you and your music for a long time. And you're just such a prominent voice in the music scene. I came across this really powerful post that you made about your recovery. And I didn't even realize you were in recovery. And, I thought, man, this is a great guy to have on. Like, what a voice. It's also a side that we haven't touched upon, the music industry and all of the occupational hazards that come along with that,
Sure. Yeah. No, it's been 17 years for me this year. And I think it seems to be there's a lot more people kind of, in our secret society these days in the business. But I'm happy to talk about it. Absolutely.
That's great, man. So, I always like to get a bit of a backstory and, get you up to that point of really making that change and entering the world of recovery where, everybody has a different kind of, focal point on when things kind of started for you. Did addiction kind of come into your life really early on, or is this something that, was more environmental? Or
I think it was environmental, of course, growing up in a traumatic household, physical abuse and emotional, mental abuse. And then kind of discovering alcohol when I was, about 11 or 12 was the first time that I took a drink, and I was by myself, or it was maybe the first time I got drunk. I was by myself and I found a bottle of wine and it had already turned. So it was like really gross, but I remember feeling, the first time feeling that warmth and like kind of just escaping reality for the first time. And then it just naturally progressed, like a normal teenager, with partying and then just like a lot of partying.
Right.
And I just, I never, of course, back then and you don't have any frame of reference of recovery, or there was nobody in my life that was in recovery, no uncles or anything. It was all fairly drinking, centric culture. And then, through teenage years, into my 20s, and then playing music for a living, where it's like, okay, great. I can continue to party and like someone else is paying for it now.
Right. So when you're a teenager, you don't really think about it. Everyone's kind of doing the same thing. There's no real way that you can view
it's where very where normal. It's very right. normalized, and then.
So I guess then, you're coming out of a scene where it is normalized into a scene where it's normalized.
It's really normalized. Right. And then it's subsidized, it's paid for. And we kind of wore that as a badge of honor, as musicians in the early days. I grew up in Victoria and was in the punk rock scene, so there's a lot of drugs and alcohol, and then moved into I lived with Hot Heat on Richardson Street downtown here, and they of course were signed with Warner Brothers, and everything was free. We'd get boxes of Levi's and Fluvog shoes, and any bar in town we walk into, and our drinks were always paid for.
Right.
So there was this culture of excess and drugs, and it was fun when you're young, and then it starts to not become fun. And I think my drinking kind of came to a head when I was 25, and I felt I was on tour. I'd been touring as a full-time musician by that point. And I just woke up one day and knew something needed to change. I was in a really rough spot, and I was in the middle of a tour, and I couldn't drive myself from the gig to gig. So someone from the other band that I was touring with had to drive my vehicle with me, you know, passed out in the back, essentially. And I kind of woke up, and I had this voice in my head that was basically telling me I needed to like find a way to stop. They just kept saying it's the booze. Like that was just like this voice in my head over and over again. And I remember finishing the tour and a long drive home. That voice kept coming, and I was like weeping and listening to this music. And I was like, what is going on? So I decided to I decided to like stop drinking for a month to see how it would feel. And I'm 25. I'm still a kid, right? You know, so I stopped for a month, and then I felt okay, I guess. And I think then I had to go on tour in Scotland. And I thought, well, like a lot of great alcoholics, we decide, well, we'll just, I think I was the reverse, actually. I think I decided to stop beer and only drink hard liquor because I mostly drank beer.
Right. Okay.
So I was like, okay, well, I'll be okay. I'll take like the civilized, the civilized approach, and I'll just have some cocktails. And of course that just, I drove that into the ground. And then, I actually found myself on tour in Alaska in the wintertime. And two of the artists that I was touring with, one morning they're like, okay, we're going to go to this thing, we'll be back in a couple hours. And I was like, well, where are you going? And they're like, oh, just a thing, you know, that we're gonna do. And finally I pestered out of them that they were going to an AA meeting. Okay. And they said, oh, and I said, well, I'd like to go. Right. And they're like, really? And I'm like, yeah. And they're like, oh, we figured you had another 10 years in you still.
Right. Right.
And I think I had hit my rock bottom. I was exhausted, I was tired. As a musician, I didn't like music was the last thing on my mind. I just wanted to get fucked up. So I couldn't wait to get off stage so I could drink myself to sleep. Right. And I walked into my first ever AA meeting in Anchorage, Alaska, and 17 years ago this January. And, through the fellowship and the principles of AA I'm a program guy, but that's obviously not the only way to get sober. It worked for me and it's worked for a lot of my friends. But I walked into that room and felt the fellowship and saw other people like me that were suffering and needed a way out from alcohol and drugs. And I haven't looked back since.
Oh, wow. Okay.
There's been a couple moments, you know.
Yeah.
I think, and I got sober there, and, you know, by the grace of God is something we like to say, but I was also with sober people that I really looked up to at touring at that time.
Right.
And prominent musicians that I really looked up to. And then I started to notice that a lot of my heroes were sober too.
Right.
But, you know, you get sober and AA and sobriety is one thing, but dealing with your demons is a whole another level. And I remember about a month into some of my sobriety, you know, I had some physical detox things going on. I had really bad stomach pains and everything, the my whole body had completely changed. Certain things all right. of a sudden it was allergic to. And so I was really wrestling for about a month, but I had this strange thing. I don't think I've ever talked about this, on the record, but I had this hole, this dark pit, in my heart. It was like right where my heart should be. Okay. And I didn't know what was going on. All I know, I was like, I was really fucked up over it. I was happy to not be drinking, but I wasn't happy. And, I went to a therapist, this little Buddha of a lady named Bonnie Lee. I don't even know if she's still alive, at the University of Lethbridge. I don't know how I got this into see her, but she's really good. She was really respected in the university and those scenes. And she sat me down and you know, I'm pretty, like I said, I was 25. So I was a little bit insecure and not as, you know, open-hearted as I am now. And she's like, tell me what's going on. And I was reluctant to say, I was embarrassed to say, like, there's a black hole. Right. And I got it. She got it out of me. And she, you know, I said, there's this black hole. Right. Of this pit of sadness.
Right. Yeah,
like real sadness, there, man. Right. I felt like it was rough. It was raw. And anybody who's listening that's gone through recovery knows that rawness at the beginning. And finally she said, well, where is the pit? And where's the black hole? And I was so embarrassed. And finally I just said, like, it's right here. I pointed at my heart. And she's like, so she's like, you have a black hole in your heart. And I'm like, yeah. And it was actually the first time that I'd really, really realized.
Articulated it. Yeah.
And then, so then, you know, through, her, she's, like I said, she was a really good therapist. I've been to some really bad ones over the years, but she was really good. And she drilled down with me and she got to the crux of that black hole. And it was, you know, dad issues, like a lot of people that are in recovery and out and active in their addiction and recovery. It's parental things. And so we did some, I don't know what the term is, but we did some, like, you know, visualization work. And I finally had the courage to talk to my parents and immediately the black hole was gone. As soon as we did that visualization work where she had me sit down in a chair and, you know, pretend that it was at, you know, for in this instance, it was my dad, was across in a chair, from me and what I needed to say to him.
Right.
And just that act of doing that, that saying what I need, that I've been holding on since I was a little kid, it immediately disappeared.
Right.
No more black hole.
Right.
And, so, you know, if that to me is such a powerful story about how our bodies keep, you know, to that trauma.
100%.
And if you're listening and you're out there and you know what I'm talking about, if you're in recovery or active, how our bodies hold on this tension, and just this deep pain and suffering that goes along with, you know, the childhood trauma stuff. But so that, you know, that disappeared, that black hole disappeared then. And of course I, you know, was active in recovery and 12 step meetings for probably 3 to 5 years after my sobriety, and went through all sorts of shit in that time too, you know,
having to navigate life on different terms.
Absolutely,
all of a sudden, right?
Man. Yeah. Like you know, I wrote a record, about a year after I got sober called Everything Is Real. And that particular song, it really, for me, I really needed to find a way to, like, articulate what I was feeling, which was this extreme rawness and vulnerability, but also this, like, vivid color and life for the first time. And to actually feel my emotions versus to push them away or numb them out. 'Cause it's like a really crazy buzz in a weird way. And it started to, like, I started to get high, for real,
right.
You know, off real life. And it's a different way. It's a different high, but it was like, it was almost a lot, like it was a lot.
Right. You know what I mean? Yeah. No,
it's like a crazy caffeine buzz or something where you're just like, I don't know how to like filter all this like emotion.
It's a brand new thing to navigate. Right?
Yeah. So that was, you know, so I make records about it when what I'm feeling. That's what I do. I write songs and make records about what I'm feeling and going through. And so that record, Everything Is Real, is a real recovery record in a lot of ways. So, you know, there was moments in time where it was only a few times where I almost slipped. One time was in Austin, Texas, at South by Southwest. And it was just, I was feeling real good. And, it was, the party was really kind of happening. And I remember hanging out with Lucinda Williams, and she was well into the cups. And I was like, well, maybe if I just, and I kind of, you know, I don't think I called anybody. I kind of white knuckled it and just got through the night and didn't drink. And the next day I probably called somebody and was like, I don't know what happened last night. You know?
Yeah,
I didn't, and then I realized like, okay, I still have things to deal with, you know?
Right. Yeah. Trauma. It's not just something that you walk away from. It's
not really.
You have to kind of learn to manage.
Not once.
Yeah.
You know, I think, you know, when I had my first kid was another time where things got really dark for me, which is weird. It's not that I was like, you know, I loved him when he showed up and stuff. And it wasn't that I really wanted to be a dad, and it was that, but it basically put a mirror to my childhood trauma, seeing him for the first time, you know, come out, and like all of a sudden I saw myself, and I saw my brother who passed away really young, traumatically, when I was, you know, eight or 9 years old.
Oh, man.
And then in that sobriety journey, I realized how deep the trauma went,
right?
You know, and how I'd never reckoned with my brother's death.
Right.
And this is like, you know, 14 years, 15 years into my sobriety.
Right.
So
still coming to the surface.
Yeah. And I don't want to speak for anybody else in recovery, but, I still suffer, you know, like I still have a lot of darkness, and luckily there's people that have helped me filter that darkness into energy. And, and you know, I remember, like I said, you know, recovery and 12 steps is just the thing that got me sober. But the thing that got me well is therapy. Like really, it really is. And I've continued to do it, and I'm still like at different levels of my therapy and healing. And in this last 2 years has been a whole nother journey into going through my childhood and going back in time. I'm not a therapist, so I don't know the methods, but, it's like kind of like parts based, something family therapy that I'm doing right now. And, it's powerful stuff, man. It's really powerful stuff. And it's a shedding of this sadness that I've been holding on to. But I remember early on in, when I first really started to delve into therapy, I showed up, I was on, I was supposed to go on tour with Los Lobos, play in Chicago, 3 nights in Chicago. And I got to the airport, and I stopped dead in my tracks as soon as I walked in the airport door. The big sliding doors came open.
Right.
I walked in and my body just froze. And I was like, whoa, what's going on?
Out of nowhere?
Out of nowhere. Like I was anxious, you know, to fly and to be away from my kid at the time because he was little. And I'd had a new manager. I just got a new manager she's with me still. And I just froze. And I was like, this is strange. And I was just paralyzed with fear. And I was like, there's no way I can get on that plane. I can't even get to the gate or the desk, you know? And, so I phoned my manager, and I was like, listen, I can't get on the plane. And I've been through, you know, multiple managers before that would just be like, get on the fucking plane, you know, like, what are you doing? And she was like, you know what? Don't even worry about it. Go back to your car and drive home. Like, it's all good. And I was like, okay, I picked the right person here, and called my wife. And she's like, what are you talking about? And so as soon as that happened, it was another, it was almost like that moment where, when I realized that I needed to get sober when I was young, you know,
right.
I realized like, I need to get well, like this right. is not good. So started my, therapy journey after that. And one of the second therapist I had, he's a great, great guy. And I said, it was right after that, I couldn't get on the plane and I showed up and I said, okay, you gotta fix me, like fix right. this.
What's going on here?
Yeah. And he looked at me and he said, I don't think this darkness will ever not be a part of you. And right. I was like, he's like, you need to learn how to live with this.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
And I was like, what are you talking about? Like, what am I fucking paying you for here? You know, right. like get
yeah.
rid of
get
it
out of me. Yeah.
yeah. And he kind of gave me some books, some Buddhist books. And that was kind of the start of my mindfulness, meditation and Buddhist, journey, you know, my practice with that.
Right.
And you know, I don't mention these things as to say, you know, I feel like these are all really big parts of my sober journey.
Right.
To be yeah. honest, to like see the yeah. truth in it. 'Cause what I think we need to understand why we medicate ourselves in the first place. We need right. to understand that to, 'cause right. it's not like, there's so much shame and guilt wrapped up in what the things that we've done as when we're active in our addictions that, you know, that in itself is such a, you know, a mountain to climb.
Just, yeah. It's that gasoline
it
on
really
the fire.
It really is. It
right?
really
yeah.
is, man. 'Cause you get sober and you're feeling raw and then you start thinking of all the bad things you do. And, you know, part of the 12-step program is writing that stuff down.
Right, that reconciliation.
Thank God. Right, you know, and thank God that, you know, when I read those things to my sponsor, he was just like, oh, you know, yeah, come on. We've all done those things. And I'm just like, what? And he's like, yeah, no, you know, and then like the act of burning that list and asking for forgiveness or finding a way to like humble ourselves. In some ways, like I found 12-step, like a lot of people have an issue with it, but I was so happy to like give myself to it.
Right.
Because
yeah.
I think it like, it pulverized my ego.
Right.
And some people think that that's unhealthy. I found that, I needed to like lose it. I needed
you.
To
yeah.
lose it. And not only that, it rebuilt it in a really healthy positive way.
Right. It's
you
not
know.
Breaking it down to leave you there. It's
no,
breaking it down
no.
so you can start afresh.
And
right.
that's what the 12 step is all about
yeah.
to be active service. Right. Mm. So I needed, my ego needed to be gone. Like it needed to be
right.
abolished, you know, like I'd been, young and I had a lot of eyes on me really early and a lot of excess and all those things and it wasn't healthy, especially if someone who, you know, grew up feeling pretty useless and so when when you get older and all of a sudden everybody tells you how great you are all the time, it's not healthy,
right?
Especially when you have addictions and you know that's another thing, the dopamine addiction, and because that I guess that's kind of one of the things that they're discovering is that that's really all we're looking for is dopamine
right.
kick
that hit.
So I still struggle with I just don't struggle with alcohol and drugs anymore, but I still have addictions and addiction
right.
addictive personality that I have to like keep on top of, you know.
Right.
So after, you know, rebuilding my ego and sense of self and then also going through therapy and now, you know, mindfulness and Buddhism is a really big part of it. And it's not like I think that everybody needs to have spirituality or anything like that. But for me, it's like what it does is it illuminates, it gives me answers as to what I know that what's wrong with me, that language is, it's not that anything's wrong with me, but
sure.
it allows me to see what my shortcomings are and why they are, and allows me to be honest with myself.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and as we know, as addicts and alcoholics, like, honesty is not always the easiest thing.
Right.
You know, to,
you can pretty easily sell yourself a line without even knowing
it. And you know
it.
What? Yeah. Like, we learn how to lie really good to survive when we're young.
Yeah.
You know, like, we learn how to lie really good because that's how, that's how we get fed, or that's how, you know, it's like, that's how we don't get the shit kicked out of us, is because, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So we, as people that are suffering from trauma or addiction, you know, so you learn to lie. And then of course, when you get caught, or when you see that your lies have hurt somebody else or hurt yourself, then the shame thing comes
right.
So,
the spot, right.
And that's where we get in trouble is we start to feel that cycle of shame, and then we go, well, if I just use or drink, then that'll at least take care of that shame.
At least for now.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. And then
you don't have to look at this right now.
That's right. And then the cycle starts all over again.
Right.
So, you know, I think that, like, recovery for me will be a lifelong thing. It'll be a lifelong journey.
Yeah.
And each of these stages is just, you know, setting me up for the next thing, and hopefully that's success,
right?
In recovery, you know, I don't think about using at all anymore, not even close. But I know that, you know, there's an old adage that, you know, our addictions just sitting there waiting for us
doing push-ups in the parking lot.
Yeah, push-ups in the parking lot, which I love that, you know, because it's true. And I've seen it time and time again. I've had friends that have gone back out and some, you know, didn't make it back. And that to me is, you know, I'm too scared to kind of fall back into that trap. I got too much to lose now with being a dad and other people looking up to me is in recovery is important too, you know?
I mean, for me, just the fact that you're still looking at it, that, hey, I'm still working on this and I'm still having to put effort into my recovery and I'm not taking this for granted. I think it's a testament to long-term, you know, to why you've, you know, found long-term sobriety. Cause you see that so many times people feel that they're, I've kind of got this sorted. I've got this figured out.
Sure.
And next thing you know, it comes back full force. You know, and
are you in recovery? Or are you?
I'm not in recovery per se. Yeah. I've family members and you know, walked along beside a lot of people and you know, I had to make some changes in my life in my early years for sure. But I never say officially that I'm in recovery.
Yeah,
if that makes sense.
Well, we're all dealing with our things, right? But yeah, I'm like, pride is such a weird word, you know what I mean? But I do, like, I am proud of people that are in recovery. Like, I really am, cause I know how hard it is. You know, but the reality is like, we're living in very tumultuous times, really, really traumatic times. And it's hard. Mm. It's hard to just be in the world. So if you've got any sort of penchant for drugs and alcohol and abusing those things, now is like really, really good time to like get on top of that and sort it out, you know?
That's a really good point. Yeah. There's nothing more dangerous than having real legitimate reasons.
I think it really does kind of come back to that shame component.
Right.
I think that's like just the biggest thing, you know. I don't know if that makes any sense, or if you see that in the work that you do. Is
I always if I personify addiction, that's what it eats up. It loves that shit. It loves the shame and the guilt,
it really
right
does,
and it
man.
Tries to perpetuate and hold on to
it. So much of this thing that I'm talking about, it really comes down to like forgiveness, forgiving yourself, and forgiving, trying to find a way to like forgive those that have done wrong by us, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The my abuser, wasn't easy, and there's still moments where I get angry.
Sure.
But I think that I've had to forgive them, You know, I think for me to finally move on, I had to kind of understand why they would do that. And not that I would think that it's justified. But I had to, I think I had to forgive, to move past it. And you know, the other thing is that I think, when I mentioned when I had my first son, there was all this anger bubbling up. And I kind of could see this like weird behavior coming out in me that was mirroring what I saw as a child, which was anger. And, of course I didn't want to like, I didn't feel like I needed to abuse my kid when I was, right. when he was little, he was just a little guy, but I could see the trajectory. Huh, I could see that if I continue with this thing inside of me, that's what I will become when he's older. I will be this ball of anger and resentment and suffering. And I didn't want to bring that to my kid. And, you know, the thing is like hatred or anger begets anger. So he'll grow up. My kids will grow up angry.
Right.
And the cycle will continue.
Just perpetuating.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So I know that, you know, there's people listening to this that understand that too, right?
Yeah. You know? And it takes a lot of guts to do something about and face that those aspects within yourself, right?
You know, thankfully I was sober when those things came to light.
Sure.
It's you know what I mean? So if I wasn't sober, I probably wouldn't have had the mind to realize like you gotta do something about this.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, the sobriety was directly the same. It was essentially the same thing. You just get to a point where you go, I'm so fucking tired of this behavior. I'm tired of being exhausted all the time. I can't put myself through this guilt and shame cycle over and over again. So what do I need to do? And for me, it was just, I happened to, you know, have some sort of divine intervention of being in Alaska of all places.
Right.
Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like there's nothing in the dead of winter.
Right.
Where it's like, it could be really, really easy to just go drink in a bar and like,
right.
You know, but I went the other way and thought, well, okay, I guess if we're going to be in Alaska in the dead of winter, I'm just going to figure out how to be sober.
Might as well
sort
myself out. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And alcoholics and addicts are the same everywhere you go, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
That's one of the beautiful things about us is that we're all human beings and we all, and, you know, that's the great thing about a 12-step meeting is that there's one in pretty much every town.
Right. The access is unbelievable, right?
It sure is. And there's people like you that are out doing this amazing work that and you guys here that are doing all this great work is that there are resources for us. It's not always easy to, like, take that first step. But, again, it's that you know, letting go of that shame and forgiving yourself and giving yourself permission to try and make your life a little bit better.
Right. I always say too, just walking through the doors is a gigantic statement in itself. Right.
Yeah. My favorite saying, I can't remember, and I tend to always butcher these things, but my favorite one is, it might not always get easier, but it will always get better.
Right.
And I love that because, you know, none of us are perfect. Life is messy. Being a human being is messy. But if we can strive for better all the time or some of the time, whenever we feel compelled to give our lives some energy, is if we can strive to be better. It might always not always be easier, but it always will be better, and I definitely agree with that.
Right.
Yeah.
It takes pain and tears and hard work, but it
sure does.
It gets you to that. Yeah.
It's fucking hard to be a human being at the best of times.
Absolutely.
So to be a human being that's stuck in a cycle of shame and guilt is really, really hard. It's too hard. It's too hard.
Right.
I remember that. I just remember everything in my body, every cell in my body hurt.
Right.
Right. And it was just like, I just, please, no more. Like, you know, no and more.
Did that kind of impetus for change, was it like you were saying, like in this kind of one trip that you, it was accentuated, like the precipitating years up to that, like was there, you know, did you kind of know in the back of your mind, or were you in that kind of pre-contemplative stage where you're just going for it and this is just what life is as a musician? Or I, like, you know, or, yeah, were there those sobering moments kind of along the way?
I think I'm a pretty spiritual person, and I think that like signs and circumstances and intervention is such a beautiful thing. But I remember being a shithead little punk and growing up in the Cowichan Valley and walking by those newsstands with like, Common Ground magazine or something with like meditators on the front. And I'd always be like totally drawn to those books and going like, that's something I'm going to do someday.
Okay.
But like,
it's like this foreshadowing.
Yeah. Almost. Like not even close to where I was at the time.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
One day I'm going to do that. But right now I'm going to go spray paint that garbage can and like try to kickflip over that curb or whatever, you know,
knock the shit
and
over.
Run away from the cops. Yeah. Like, but that's what I'm going to do. But one day I'm going to do that. So I think like, you know, now that I think I'm more awake as a human being and open to my potential and my heart is much more open than it ever was back then. I felt pretty closed off back then, to be honest. Mm-hmm. Like I felt really tight and restricted back then.
Right.
And I find myself like falling back into that tightness nowadays, but now I have the tools to like, to open up to it.
Right.
So yeah, there was foreshadowing. I also remember one of my bandmates once, I said, you want coffee or something? He's like, I don't drink coffee. And I was like, what do you mean you don't drink coffee? And he said, I'm going to save that vice for when I'm sober. Mm. One day when I get sober. And he was like,
okay.
He was wild. He was, he was in the dark, deep trenches with me.
Yeah.
And I think that was probably the first time that I was like, huh?
Right.
What do you mean? Like what?
We're not just going to do this forever.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So there was these like little signposts along the way, that I feel were kind of there, or maybe like even in dreams or, those deja vu feelings, you know, that you get.
Yeah.
But now like it was never normalized in the culture, especially like in music or touring. It was not a thing. It was just go as hard as you possibly can.
Right. So when you're, you know, for the young musicians in town or even people like in the trades, in the kitchens, you know, substances go so hand in hand with the occupation, you know, and I mean, yeah, going on tour, that's a hard place to stay sober, right? Or even, club after club, you know, what do you say to people like that are trying to navigate those waters?
I think the culture's changed so much, especially in music and touring. I think it's gotten better. But for anybody who's out there that is active in their addiction, what I want to say is like, yeah, sure, it's easy to say like, oh, you know, there is hope. And yeah, like obviously that's the case. But the reality is I think for me, I think it's like you have to just take an honest look at your life and where you're at and how you feel and what you want out of your life. If you're lying to yourself, and stuck in the shame and guilt cycle, I think maybe it's time to like take an honest look at where you're at and at your soul. And are you living how you're supposed to be, or that you, how you want to be living, is like rigorous honesty. Is such a big part of the 12 step, and it's real, because you can only lie to yourself for so long, you know?
Right. Yeah.
So if you're tired of lying to yourself, maybe take the first step to that road of recovery, because it doesn't always get easier, but it always gets better.
Right. Yeah. always say that recovery is possible for everyone. It just takes a lot of hard work, right?
And, yeah.
And being gentle on yourself. You're totally right. That kind of forgiveness piece, I think, is so key. I don't think we can say that enough.
Absolutely.
Right?
I see so much suffering in the streets here. And I do really think that there needs to be better resources for people that are really far down the road of their addiction and shame. So, you know, I think that we have to give a lot of grace and we have to give a lot of mercy to the people that are still out there in their active addictions. We have to keep an open heart for those people and hopefully, you know, hopefully one day there'll be resources for everybody that needs it, you know?
Yeah. I think that's always the heartbreaking, you know, when we go down, we've times where we just go down and chat with everybody on the block and, you know, just hearing how many people have tried, you know, I think there's this idea that everybody's just down there wanting to be down there and man, what, you know, I think there are some people who are kind of, you know, in it for a while and aren't wanting to make a change. But for me, there was more than half the people were just scared or didn't, or had tried and burned, you know, fuck it. It takes a lot of courage to go, you know what, I'm going to do something about it. And then to get let down by the, like you say, the lack of resources.
That's heartbreaking to me. Right. Yeah. And I think the farther down the rabbit hole you go or farther down your road of addiction and shame, the harder it is to kind of climb out. It's not, I think everybody is capable of recovery. I really do believe that, but it's not as easy for everybody.
The path gets harder, right? Yeah.
You know, some people need a little bit more help and more resources. And I don't know, you know, I don't know. I guess I am really grateful for people like you and resources like this and for the 12-step programs, because I think that most of the time I do think that I'd probably be dead if I was continued. If not dead, like in a really bad spot.
Right. Yeah. The trajectory wasn't. Yeah.
I wouldn't have the career that I have. I don't think I'd have my marriage or my kids or, you know, the life that I have now.
Yeah. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Do you ever go back for a meeting or to get your cake or anything like that? Or is there any guest appearances?
Absolutely. And I would always go if anybody wanted me to go to a meeting with them, I'll always go. I still live with the principals every day. I still talk to recovering alcoholics all the time and we talk about our program, and I still, you know, that's not an excuse. I should be at meetings all the time because of, you know, the fellowship and also just the service. That's a big part of it. But, you know, like for me, this, I guess, would be an act of service.
Absolutely.
Talking about it and going on online and talking about my recovery openly as an act of service. I still live by the principles. I still recite the Serenity Prayer all the time.
Oh, that's,
And a lot of the time on the road, I'll have like many meetings with other people in recovery. And,
No, that's so encouraging to hear, you know, and I think that's great that it's just so incorporated into your daily life. And,
I really do think that if you're gonna do, I think like do the steps, that's really important, you know.
Yeah, I
think if people are gonna follow the 12-step path, I think the 12 steps are there for a reason, and it's not, maybe not comfortable to go through it, but once you get to the other side of those 12 steps, and the 12th step is, you know, it's to be of service of other alcoholics and addicts. And that's a really, really, really big part of it. And I remember when I got called for my first 12 step, I was scared. I didn't know what to expect. And it wasn't pretty.
Right.
It wasn't pretty, man. It ended up with, you know, me holding this kid's hand in the emergency room while he was having seizures, alcoholic seizures. And And he was scared, you know, he's so scared, and you could smell that smell. I could smell that, like, smell of alcohol and adrenaline. Right. And it was just like, oh my God, like,
yeah.
I'm so grateful to be sober. And he, right. yeah, he died, you know, he died a year later.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if he was sober or not, or, you know, but I've also had, yeah, I've lost friends in this, and it's not to be taken lightly.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
This shit is real.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and like I said, I think it takes, you know, it takes a lot of courage to start doing something about it. And for me, I'm grateful. I say this all the time with, you know, everybody who comes on the podcast, but just, you know, for somebody with you, with your notoriety, being able to post something like that on Facebook and just uh-huh. be real about your recovery. Like, for me, I have so much respect, and I think that it's so, I think it's one of the most empowering things, for people that are looking to make that change
yeah.
is just to see people that they look up to yeah. that have gone through it and are also comfortable talking about it without that shame and guilt. Cause it does kind of break that, you know, that stigma, you know, and
it's true. It's true. I think that the world needs some truth right now, especially. Right. And I know yeah. like, you know, in the 12-step program, we do have a thing about anonymity at the level of press and film and all that. And I think that, you know, I don't want to speak for anybody else, but I think that for me, I actually need to hear those voices normalized.
Right.
So I've decided to speak openly about it. And, you know, I don't want to, I would never out anybody else or that didn't want to be or whatever.
Right.
But yeah, I think that's like, I think we need to normalize speaking about it, and we need to be able to talk about it on places like this so that other people that are listening understand that there's an alternative to suffering, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, listen, man, you know, you're very inspirational, but you know, both musically and, you know, like I said, just being able to be so real about, you know, your journey. And like I said, I know that's, doesn't come easily for some people, but I really appreciate it. I think it's really a powerful message.
Yeah,
and,
thank you.
Yeah. And thanks I appreciate for the work you taking the time. I know how busy you are. So, I appreciate you taking the time out of your, thanks, out of your busy week. Yeah. Cool. Thanks, brother. Wow. What an absolute pleasure. I want to thank Leroy once again for taking time out of his busy schedule to come in and share his story, and to be so vulnerable and open about the challenges he's faced along the way. You know, for me, that's powerful when people can open up and be, you know, 100% real and honest about the challenges that they faced. You know, something that really struck me was, you know, a lot of times we hear about the ups and downs, the struggles about getting sober, you know, the challenge and the process of getting sober. And for me, you know, it sounds like from his account that, you know, it was almost like a switch flicked for him in his sobriety where he became sober. But the amount of work that goes in once you're sober, actually having to figure out what are you going to do with all these feelings and emotions and your past. And, you know, getting to a place of being able to be comfortable in your own skin and moving forward and progressing as a human. I am so impressed by the amount of work that Leroy has put in, and being able to speak so eloquently and openly about it is incredibly inspiring. So thank you again to Leroy. And on a personal note, when Leroy was talking about, you know, brushing shoulders and going out with Lucinda Williams, that's, she doesn't know it, but that's you know, another love of my life. She's my absolute hero. So I got a little starstruck when he was speaking about his time down south with Lucinda. As far as this program is concerned, we will be back in a couple of weeks with another amazing individual telling their story of recovery. I'm going to keep these coming all the way through the spring and budding up into summer here. So thank you for listening. I've had multiple people, even the last couple of weeks, come up and tell me that they're listening to the podcast, and it really is inspiring them to see change and to do good things, you know, in their recovery and in the recovery community around them. So thank you so much for everybody who has come on to this podcast and been able to be vulnerable and share their story. It really means a lot. Once again, we'll see you in a couple of weeks. Until then, be safe and know that recovery is possible. We are here for you if you need us. My name is Blake Anderson.